him. The shop bell rang out again as she rushed forward to get the carriage started. Rory watched in delight as she pushed it down the track so that it whirled around, the bright reds and greens a blur. Rory clapped his hands together. "Gain! Gainer!" A small group of children pushed in from outside, diving behind the legs of their mothers, and one lone father, who seemed a little lost in the commotion as Clara beckoned them forward to show them all again. The shop was suddenly filled with giggles and voices and people moving in between the aisles, and she felt her whole body loosen, her feet light as she slipped behind the counter. One boy, missing both front teeth, was craning his neck to see the selection of toys on a top shelf. "Do you want me to get anything down for you?" Clara asked, which made the boy stare at the floor before biting his lip and then nodding furiously. He pointed to a large box just above Clara's head, and she lifted it down. "What do you say, Chris?" A woman whom Clara assumed to be the boy's mother appeared behind him. "Thanks," the boy said, staring through the plastic window of the box at the remote-controlled car inside. "Is that what you want, then?" the woman asked him. The boy nodded at her, air whistling through his teeth as he said, "We could make a track in the office." He turned to Clara. "My dad moved out, so he doesn't need it anymore," he explained. "They have to get a divorce now." "Oh," Clara said, taken aback at this information. "Chris!" The woman went pink. "God, sorry. He's telling everyone at the moment. It's like divorce Tourette's." The boy was still glazing at the box. "This is so cool," he breathed. "It's his birthday," the woman added. "His dad sent an e-card," she rolled her eyes, "so I thought I'd better make up for it." "I can wrap it up for you if you want. I've got paper and bows and things." "Thanks, you are sweet," the woman said, handing over money and smiling at her. "But it will be totally wasted on him. It'll stay in the box for about 2 seconds." "My dad moved out when I was about your age," Clara said to the boy, who looked at her with large, solemn eyes. "He still loves you, though." The boy took a breath. "That's what he said." He didn't look sure. The mother smiled at Clara over his head, mouthing a thank you before steering him towards the door. "Come on, Chris, we'll be back another day." Lauren dashed across the shop. "Well done, Clara! Seriously, it's ace! Can you come over on Monday afternoon? Patrick takes Rory swimming and it's my opportunity to exercise and stuff." She smiled. "I could do with some company. I'll leave my address. 3 p.m.? Clara nodded over the blip of another till entry. "I will, thank you. I will, definitely." "And I'll be telling everyone to get down here," Lauren said, fetching Rory from where he and two other boys had started to build a fort out of beanbags and boxes. Clara smiled, watching her pick him up, his little legs kicking as she removed him from the shop. "More, Mama, more!" Then the next customer distracted her and she was back to the till, tapping in the amount to be paid, looking up moments later to see the ominously still presence of Roz staring into the shop from the pavement. Her mouth puckered in disapproval as her eyes roved over the display in the window. Clara had a sudden urge to laugh. "Oh, Lord," she muttered. "What's that?" the lone father asked. His green eyes behind thick designer glasses seemed to sparkle with amusement. "Ah," Clara blushed, looking at the little girl in his arms. "It means, have a nice day, in Danish," she said, feeling her toes curl with the lie.
"Lot, lot,"
the little girl repeated. Clara grimaced, hoping her dad wouldn't Google the word when he got home. The man didn't notice her expression, giving her a grin as he paid for a train carriage.
"Great display. You got a real eye for detail."
Clara found herself strangely shy as she caught his gaze. "Thanks," she mumbled, forgetting all about Roz.
"Amber loves it, don't you, Amber?" he asked.
Amber was already holding out her hand for the carriage, wriggling and bucking to get down. The man deposited her on the ground and ruffled her hair, the same light brown as his own. Totally overexcited. If only her mum could see her. He tailed off, sighing out loud so that Clara found herself tilting her head to one side in sympathy. "Still," he said, clapping his hands together, "this has cheered us up." He grinned, light reflecting off his glasses. "I'm glad," Clara said, wanting to talk more but aware of another customer standing behind him. The man gave her a sloping smile and waved a hand.
"Well, see you round," he said.
"You too," Clara replied, watching him take his daughter's hand and lead her out of the shop. Was it her imagination, or did he pause at the door to look back at her? The next customer cut across her musings. "Excuse me, what does the large wooden number 4 mean in the corner of the window?" "The 4," Clara blinked, still thinking back to the lone father and child. "The 4," she repeated. "It means 4 days to go."
"To go till what?"
the woman asked. Her son was staring up at Clara, waiting for her response. Clara pulled herself together, bending down to his eye level. "Until the next display. 4 days, and then overnight it will transform into something else."
"Like magic," the boy said, his eyes bulging.
"Exactly. When I wake up and come downstairs, I find it completely different."
"Elves," the boy whispered.
Clara nodded solemnly.
"Very likely," she agreed.
The mother broke into a smile.
"Well, Lucas, we'll have to come back and see that, won't we?" "In 4 days," Lucas repeated, as if his mother were an imbecile.
"Exactly. 4 comes after," she asked him.
2,
he replied solemnly. The woman looked at Clara and grimaced.
"He's not entirely wrong," she lowered her voice, "but I might have a word with the nursery."
"Right," she said more loudly. "We'll see this nice lady in 4 days, then. Say thank you."
The boy was too busy staring at the box he was carrying.
"Nanku."
"That'll do."
"What do you mean you hated my chocolate surprise? You told me at the time that it was a groundbreaking dessert. I shall never believe another word that passes your lips. Is Sense and Sensibility really your favourite Emma Thompson film? And do you really find Noel Edmonds loathsome too? You see, I am now second-guessing everything you've ever told me. It rained for 2 days on the trot in Madrid, so I took a coach to Valencia. The journey itself was utterly hideous, but it's lovely to be on the coast and looking out on the Mediterranean. The sun has decided to welcome me here, and I've been out exploring. It's a strange place. Some parts look like the set of a sci-fi movie, all large white buildings and shallow turquoise pools. I keep expecting chaps in white helmets to appear on the horizon. I've cycled just about everywhere today. The old river has dried up, so they've transformed it into green parks and cycle paths. It's all rather lovely. My shins ache now, though, so I've retired to the rooftop of the hotel, which has a hot tub looking out over the beach. It is terribly hard, Gavin, being such an intrepid explorer. I have had to drink a great deal of sangria to ensure that I'm really soaking up the Spanish culture."
"Maybe you should do a Spanish-themed evening in the pub. Serve paella and sangria and hire someone to do flamenco. I watched a woman in a small bar in the city doing it. She was just incredible. Stamping her feet so fast they were a blur, body twisting impossibly, ruffled skirts flying. It was breathtaking. I think back to my energetic efforts when the Macarena comes on the jukebox and feel horribly inept. Do think about it. It would be such fun. Although I'm not sure where one finds an authentic flamenco dancer in Suffolk. There's a quarter-final of something tennis-related on tomorrow at L'Agora, an enormous strange-looking building that looks like a monster muscle coming out of the ground, and Andy Murray is playing, so I've booked tickets to watch him. I'm going to go dressed in a Union Jack flag and paint my face like one of those fanatical types at Wimbledon and see if I get on television. If the tennis is on Sky, be sure to check in.
I imagine they're bound to feature me. My sign will say, Go Andy, because everyone uses tennis players' first names. Do you remember when we all called Henman Tim, as if he was a favourite son? It's very strange. I wouldn't dream of calling Rooney Wayne. How are Man U getting on? I do miss watching Match of the Day with you. I learnt such a lot. I still shake my fist when I see Ronaldo on the back pages of the papers here because I remember you don't like him. Will you send Roddy and Lady Carcar my very biggest kisses and tell Clara she's an absolute saint? I did like her face, so it's nice to know I was right about her. She has the most fabulous skin, doesn't she? As if she's never seen a line in her life. I imagine in Denmark she just eats raw eggs and red cabbage. Do you mind asking her for any tips? I keep forgetting to use my night cream, so it's no wonder I look like something that was dragged up from the ocean. I've been avoiding Joe's calls all week. Is that terrible? He just sounds so cross with me on the answer phone, and I do hate it when he's cross with me. Oh, and I did like the way you attached all your letters to my word. To and at were acceptable, but don't think I didn't notice J-E and the J on the double letter, which seems incredibly unfair when you can't possibly tell me what it means. If you talked in your Words with Friends language, no one would understand a word you say. Still, I will soon catch up. I have a couple of rather fabulous letters up my sleeve.
Chapter 10
Mum? Mum!
He hung up again, crossing the lobby of his building, his shoes clacking on the marble surface, the sound echoing round the cavernous space. He pushed through the revolving doors, pressing her name again. The Mercedes was waiting, engine running, in the bay outside. Joe didn't recognise the driver, but he wasn't one for chatting with the chauffeurs the firm used, often working in the back of the car. He had already told the man the destination when he'd booked it, so there was no need to do anything but try his mother for the 10th time that hour. She'd been running around a harbour in Valencia looking for a boat when she'd suddenly disappeared.
"Darling, thank goodness. Do you keep going through tunnels?"
"No, I think it's you. I'm just in the car heading home."
"But it's so early."
"I stayed all night."
Joe rubbed at his face with one hand, the conversation already making him weary.
"Gosh, you are so diligent. Is the job going well? Everyone keeps asking me all about you, and I always struggle to pin down exactly what you do. Isn't that awful? After so many years. But I just say M&As in a very knowledgeable sort of way, as I know that means mergers and acquisitions, and, darling, they are always impressed. Always. Then I get a bit bogged down in the details. What are you again? Your title? I know it's something presidential. It always makes me giddy with how important you sound."
"Mum."
Joe's head had been aching on and off since midnight, and now with this whirlwind of chatter he found he just couldn't think. He needed to talk to her, seriously, about just what she was up to.
"Senior vice president or deputy president or something. I know it's American. Mum," he said, making the driver look at him with wide eyes in the rear-view mirror.
Joe thought of cupping a hand over the phone and explaining, but what would he say? He ignored the look.
"Did you want to speak for long, as I really need to find Pedro? He's on one of these boats, but there seem to be dozens of them, and they all look the same to me."
"I want to discuss you leaving Yulthorpe, the shop, and..." Joe said, trying to cut across her.
"I'm booking a jet ski for this afternoon. I met Pedro in a bar last night, and he's organised a fabulous deal for me. 2 hours for €20. An absolute bargain, don't you think, darling? And I've never jet-skied before. It looks thrilling. I was completely put off water-skiing in my 20s when your father made me do it in choppy water off the Isle of Wight. I swallowed half the sea and got smacked in the face by one of the skis. I still think I might have fractured my nose. The bottom half of it has always been angled slightly to the left since then."
The rare mention of his father had stopped Joe from responding. He was suddenly a young boy again, desperate for more stories about his dad, not wanting to ask his mum, who always seemed to get angry or tearful when he did. He imagined his father teaching his stepsister and brother how to water ski. Joe had never tried. Why did it still sting?
I think jet skiing will be just my cup of tea. I'm going to have to wear a wetsuit, though, can you imagine? Me squeezing into neoprene? Horrific. I'm so worried Pedro will laugh. Not that he'd be interested in someone ancient like me. He's very young. I think he might be homosexual. I'm not sure.
Mum, can you just sit still for 5 minutes while we talk about your upping and leaving?
It was just a fleeting thought I had, and you can't really ask, can you?
Joe had started to suspect his mother was avoiding things. He let her continue for a few moments, leaning his head back against the seat and closing his eyes. There was something wonderful about her voice that transported him back through the years, nestled in the crook of her arm on a sofa or bed as she made up fantastical stories for him. She had always been a great storyteller, and now she was in her element, embellishing details of her night in the bar, Pedro's clothing, his accent. Joe felt his head tip to the side, the driver pulling up outside his block. He jerked upright, realizing he was drifting off, the night's work catching up on him. His mouth was dry as he waited for the driver to open the door. He stepped out onto the pavement, thanked the man, and placed the mobile phone back to his ear, his mother not noticing anything had changed.
"Everyone wears leather trousers. I'm thinking of buying some. But do you think it's a bit mutton-dressed as? I remember Gavin saying he'd always had a crush on Olivia Newton-John, and she looked sensational in them at the end of Grease, do you remember? But then she was about 50 years younger than me, and much, much thinner."
Joe had made it up to the top floor of the block, the lift opening out into his penthouse suite. The floor-to-ceiling windows opposite were spotless, every surface wiped down, his belongings tidied away, hung up, or shut inside cupboards. He'd never been one for hoarding, but for a second even he was shocked by how stark it all looked. He should contact that interior designer again, see what she could do.
"Mum," he said,
falling onto the beige leather sofa, resting his head back.
"Focus. What happened?"
The direct question ended her soliloquy. There was silence from the other end of the line. Joe could make out a seagull's caw, some distant shouts. He pictured the harbour. Bronzed Spaniards moving from boat to boat, hauling up buckets of glistening fish, his mother standing, skirt billowing as she stared at her mobile.
"Mum," he repeated, his voice softer. "Come on. What happened?" "You just left."
He didn't want to say again. He wondered if she realized he was thinking back to those years when they'd travelled around the country together, never settling, staying in some places only for a matter of weeks. Joe had lost track of the number of schools he was enrolled in and then removed from partway through the year. He'd stopped making friends in the last few, knowing they'd be off again, searching for what he'd never been sure. Was Mum doing the same now? He'd thought she was happy, settled, and this scared him. As if the years had fallen away and she was back to the same broken woman she'd been after his dad had walked out on them, leaving overnight, a letter propped up on her dressing table. He'd never even said goodbye to Joe. They'd moved out of their house, and she talked about an exciting new start by the sea. Joe had loved the idea. What 8-year-old wouldn't want to spend their days on the beach, chasing waves, exploring rock pools, making sandcastles with moats, digging holes? The village by the sea had lasted less than 8 weeks. They'd left that for the city, a new city, Manchester, to be closer to Granny, who always smelled of pipe smoke and mustard. He'd been teased for his posh voice in that school, learnt to keep quiet in the playground to stop them from standing there exaggerating all their vowels, making him want to be swallowed up by a hole in the ground. They'd moved around like that for over 4 years before finally settling in Yulethorpe. Was she doing the same out in Spain? Running from another hurt? Had something happened? Was it more than the shop? He wished he could ask her directly. She had always shared things with him, but in recent years he'd struggled to ask her questions, talk properly about things. He'd assumed she was happy. Suddenly he was full of the same worry that had gnawed away at the insides of his 8-year-old self. When he'd sat at the top of the stairs waiting for her to come back from nights out, waiting for the click of the door, her heels on the tiled hallway floor. The relief that she hadn't left him too.
"It was so depressing, darling,"
she started, her voice barely louder than a whisper.
"People had just stopped coming in."
"To the shop?"
"To our shop," she corrected.
"I was thinking back all those years to when we first opened. People would drive for miles to visit us. Do you remember?" Joe found himself nodding, unable to speak.
"It was a wonderful place, the pulsing heart of the village. But recently it's just felt like someone has come along and pulled the plug on the whole place. It's a ghost town. If it wasn't for friends, I would have left years ago."
"So what do you want to do now, Mum?"
"I'm not sure," she said in a small voice. "I just couldn't stay any longer."
"Do you want to travel for a while? Do you want me to handle the shop?"
Her tone changed and Joe could tell he was losing her again.
"Oh, darling, I don't know what I want. This is all very serious and I'm in a spin still. Ooh, I think I see Pedro. No, no, it's just a man with very snaky hips. Honestly, I've been wandering around here for hours."
"Mum, really, let me help," Joe said, desperately trying to get back to the conversation to help her. "I could get you quotes. I could put it on the market if you want to release the capital from it. I want you to be comfortable, not to have to worry in your retirement."
"I know you do, darling. You're so good. Now, let's not talk about depressing things anymore. I really can't face it. Tell me about London. Do you have a girlfriend? Not that I'm pressuring you. I'm not desperate for grandchildren. I'm a dreadful knitter anyway, so I'd make a questionable grandma."
She was off again. He knew the conversation had come to a close, that she didn't want to talk any more about serious things. He needed to go to sleep. He had to be back in the office in a few hours. But it was great to hear her on the other end of the phone. He let her carry on, her voice washing over and through him as he closed his eyes on the leather sofa and drifted off to sleep. Chapter 11. By the end of the week, Clara felt exhausted. She needed a Sonntagsruhe, a lazy Sunday. So she spent the day taking long walks, cooking a stew, a bolognese, and more treats for the freezer from the enormous online order that had arrived, lighting the wood burner with the new logs. On Monday morning she got everything ready in the shop, putting a new wooden number in the corner of the window to count down to the next display. She couldn't help squeezing herself in excitement. She'd be unveiling it tomorrow, and she couldn't wait. She'd loved putting this one together. Just before 3 o'clock, she went upstairs to change into something she could exercise in, leggings pulled out of her bag, and a big enough top to cover any bulges. It might be good to go for a jog, she told herself, blocking out the whistle of cold wind as she turned off the high street and into a side street, heading to the end where a pair of cottages were set back from the road. Lauren's cottage was painted white with a thatched roof, tubs of lavender outside the front door, a flaking wrought iron bench beneath the window, and a large knocker on the door that Clara reached for, laughing as Lauren appeared almost immediately, dressed in black leggings, a short-sleeved T-shirt, and a neon pink headband.
"Was that a bit keen?" she asked, standing in the doorway. "They've been gone about 10 minutes, and I'm totally overexcited about you coming." "Oh, my God!"
She stopped, wrapping her arms around herself.
"It's frickin' freezing! Get inside now," she said, pulling on Clara's arm.
Clara had twisted round to look back over her shoulder. "It's all so lovely, so English."
"It is, isn't it? Although the cottage is listed, which is bad because I can never have a kitchen extension."
She pouted.
"And Patrick nearly sold it when he found out we weren't allowed to put up a sky dish."
Clara looked back at her, brow creasing.
"For Sky TV," Lauren explained, seeing her incomprehension. "Oh, of course," Clara said. "We have that in Denmark. And the internet," she added slowly, pretending to be clueless. "You're weird. Now come in," Lauren said cheerfully, standing to one side to let Clara squeeze past.
Sorry about the world's smallest corridor. Go into the room on the left. I've lit the fire, hence the absurdly thin T-shirt when it's minus 20 outside. Clara ducked into the front room. It gets that cold at home, she said, picturing the thick layer of snow that would be covering the park near their old family house in Denmark. This is magical, she said, forgetting everything and just looking around the front room with its low cream ceiling and thick wooden beams, the yellow and grey striped cushioned window seat, plastic toys loaded into a large box in the corner of the room, a few stray pieces of Lego scattered on the floor. A wood burner crackled opposite, the inside pulsing as if it had an orange heart. How gorgeous, she said, feeling instantly relaxed as she stood in front of it, holding out the palms of her hands as a sort of automatic response to any heat source. It's so nice to light it, Lauren said, following her into the room. I hardly ever do, as a toddler is essentially a flammable hazard, and I don't trust him not to scale the wire mesh, open the door, and cover himself in ashes. Or worse. She shivered at the thought. It's like he tries to head straight to danger no matter what you do. The other day he was convinced he could fly after seeing an aeroplane, followed by my dreadful explanation of the power of flight, which somehow meant he thought he could throw himself from his bed because he, quote, had a large wingspan too. I practically died hearing the thud, totally relieved to see him crying and then running away from me as I tried to check him for injury. Oh, God, I can imagine, Clara said, for a moment wondering what she herself would be like as a mother. Would she be safety-conscious, or would she let them roam free and wild? It's lovely seeing children in the shop, she went on. I'm not used to being around them, and they're so mad and joyful. I love it. They're certainly mad, Lauren confirmed. So, are you just over here for a while? From Denmark, that is. You sound so English. How have you ended up in Suffolk? Part of my travels. I've lived over here for a few years. I left my job a while back. Not wanting to expand, she continued. I originally came out this way because I wanted to see a village like the ones in Midsummer Murders. It's really big in Denmark, she explained with a laugh, keen to ensure the mood stayed light. Really? Clara nodded. Huge. DCI Barnaby is a pretty big deal. Weird, Lauren said, throwing another log on the wood burner. I worked in London for a few years, but all that is in the past now, Clara said hurriedly, picking at a loose thread on her sleeve. Fortunately, Lauren was distracted by a loud pop from the logs in the wood burner and didn't ask any more. Now, given that you've turned up in sports kit, but it's Arctic out there, why don't we do an exercise DVD? I have this one from America that is for different abilities, so we could do the first level and maybe next week go up to the next one. Okay, Clara said, pleased to be off the topic, but alarmed to be diving into the exercise part of the meeting. Let me set it up then. First, though, tea? Coffee? She moved through the kitchen as Clara called out, Coffee! Returning moments later with a tray piled high with mugs, biscuits, and even a small bowl of popcorn. Maybe we should watch a few minutes to see what we're letting ourselves in for, she suggested, opening the DVD wrapping with her teeth. Oh, it's a new one, Clara said. Lauren grimaced. Sort of. Last Christmas, in fact. Don't tell Patrick, he thinks I'm up to level 3 doing abstastic. She patted her stomach. Men are idiots, she said. She reached to put the DVD into the machine, then sat back on the sofa and pointed at the tray. Help yourself to milk or cream. It's in the small jug. And there's sugar if you want it. She grabbed a small handful of popcorn as the DVD introduction music kicked in. 10 minutes later, the coffee had been drunk, and they'd both kicked off their trainers and were curled up watching the three perspiring women on the screen lying on the floor and crunching into balls. Lauren popped a second chocolate digestive into her mouth. That looks hard, she commented, a crumb escaping from her mouth, which made Clara giggle. Do you think they are actually robots? I wonder if they exercise all day, every day, to look like that, Clara mused. I wonder if they are photoshopped. I think that's only in photos, Clara said, reaching for another biscuit. Gah, it's sickening, Lauren said, pointing at the screen.
I bet they have high-flying jobs, keep their toned bodies in perfect shape, and perform sex acts on their partners every night.
Holdekeft, Clara said, admiring one of the women's leotards.
What does that mean? Lauren asked.
I'm not sure of the exact translation. It's rude. Your equivalent is bloody hell, I think.
Oh, Lauren's eyes widened. Great, she said, twisting round to look at Clara. I keep using really stupid alternatives to swear words because I don't want Rory to pick up any. And Patrick says I'm not allowed to say frickin' anymore, which is totally not a swear word, but anyway. She reached out and put a piece of popcorn in her mouth. Teach me some Danish ones. Most of my English ones don't even make sense. Yesterday I actually said, oh, for actual fudge sake, which made me want to cry. It has to stop.
Okay, well, the rudest is probably Randkusa or Fuckdai, Clara said as Lauren practically spat out her tea.
Not sure that'll cut it, she said, wiping her mouth with the back of her hand.
Randai means the same and is pretty bad, Clara admitted. There's Kelling, which means bitch, but I like that one when I'm really cross and need to just let it out. Go to hell is gad, or you could try lot, which is sort of like poo or shit.
I like that. It sounds a lot more aggressive than it is, Lauren said, practicing it.
Lord! She pointed at the wood burner before picking up nearby Action Man and shouting, Gad! In his face.
Very good, Clara said, giggling. Oh, look! They're doing burpees, she said, pointing at the screen.
Lauren snuggled deeper into the sofa. What a woman! I feel like I'm getting thinner just being in the same room as her.
Clara rested her head back on the soft leather of the sofa, the crackling logs and the smell of popcorn making her feel woozy. For a second she closed her eyes, enjoying the warmth, thinking of home, drinking gluck around the family fireplace, playing endless rounds of cards, safe from the cold outside. She had an intense craving for Rom Cool, a rum-flavoured chocolate treat. Alarmed at the sudden lump in her throat as she remembered whose favourite they were.
This is so hooga, she said, exhaling slowly. Is that bad?
Lauren's forehead creased in worry.
No, Clara smiled. Hooga is great. It means...
Well, there's not an exact English word for it, but it sort of means things are very cozy. With the fire, the drinks, the company, the low lighting, it's all hooga.
Hooga, Lauren repeated. That's nice. I like it.
Outside, a car's headlights moved across the darkening room, and Lauren squeaked, breaking the vibe by diving off the sofa onto the floor and yelling, "Quickly, Clara! Quickly!" as she did so. In a rush, Clara followed her lead, unsure of what was happening. Lauren was lying flat on her back, knees bent as if she was about to give birth. Clara did the same, about to ask why when she heard the front door open and voices outside the room.
Lord, whispered Lauren, doing a sit-up.
Clara started giggling as she copied her, noticing biscuit crumbs on her chest as she lifted herself up. As Patrick and Rory appeared in the doorway, both women turned to look at them, puffing in their exertions. Patrick peered at them lying at haphazard angles on the floor, then glanced at the tray of empty wrappers, popcorn kernels, and coffee remnants. One eyebrow lifted.
"Good workout?" he asked.
"Hmm," Lauren said, manoeuvring herself into a sitting position and raising one arm to put it behind her head in some kind of stretch.
"Really motivating," she replied without a pause.
Clara, a terrible liar, merely nodded from her prostrate position in front of the fire. Fortunately, the room was so warm it had given them both pink cheeks, and she thought they might get away with it.
"Mama, is that an opcorn?"
"Oh, Lord."
Chapter 12. She'd stayed on for dinner with Lauren and Patrick, eating steaming bowls of risotto from trays in the living room and watching a scary movie about a writer living in a wood. Patrick had walked her back to the shop and she was grateful for the company, still replaying moments from the film in her head, jumping at the shadows. She wasn't sure what time it was when she heard the noise, her eyes snapping open, staring into black nothingness. The alarm clock's digits were saying it was just past 2 a.m. Had Roddy got up? Had Lady Carcar moved in her cage? She thought of the film, the man stalking the writer in the wood. There was the noise again. A voice, a low voice. Lying in bed, she felt fear freeze her to the sheets, her body taut, every muscle strained, listening for the next whisper of sound. There it was again. A man's groan, something bumping into something else. Oh my God, she definitely wasn't imagining this. Someone was down there. She could hear them lumbering around by the door to the shop. They were here to burgle it, to steal Saturday's takings. Why had she left the money in the till? Perhaps it was picturing herself ringing Louisa to tell her she'd allowed her to be robbed that got her moving. She placed both feet on the floor and straightened up slowly, reaching for the dressing gown she had thrown over a chair. Her mind was racing 10 moves ahead as she pulled on her slipper socks as quietly as she could. The sounds had stopped, and she paused, hoping whoever it was had changed their mind, had looked at the lock and left. Panic gripped her as she racked her brains. Had she locked the internal door? Had she remembered? She knew she had to stop them. Creeping out of bed, she scoured the flat for anything that might help her. She reached for the wooden hobby horse she had brought up to the flat earlier that day. She'd been braiding its mane, planning a cowboy window display for some time in the future. She picked it up by its head, feeling the satisfyingly heavy weight of the wood in her hands. Looping a string of fairy lights around her arm like a lasso, she felt more prepared, a surge of anger coursing through her now at the audacity of this burglar. How dare he sneak in like this and scare her? How dare he rob a toy shop? She needed to tell him he was a brant. She decided that speed was of the essence, so she flung open the door from the flat and bounded down the stairs, shouting a string of offensive words, a mixture of Danish and English. A bulky figure wearing a long dark overcoat turned towards her, his eyes widening in alarm. Her shock tactics had worked, she thought, as she raised the hobby horse above her head and hit him with the pole. "Fuck!" he said, doubling over immediately, hands raised to protect his head as she knocked him to the floor, wrapping the fairy light wire around him as quickly as she could. "What the fuck? What the hell are you... His words became muffled as the wire pressed into his face, cutting across his cheeks and mouth. He hadn't got a weapon, she noticed with relief, just a nasty bunch of keys in his hand that she quickly reached out and snatched from him. He roared out, making her leap backwards. "Give me those back! Mine!" She turned quickly, racing back upstairs to the flat to plug in the landline she'd disconnected earlier after a window company representative had rung 4 times in 30 minutes, and she had told him he was a sveen and to stick his triple-glazed PVC windows up his roo. She had done it. She had tied up a burglar. Now she needed the police to get here and she could relax. He hadn't made it into the shop, she thought with some relief. "Don't move. They're on their way. Don't try anything stupid," she found herself yelling, suddenly picturing the horror movie, and fully expecting him to start crawling towards her up the stairs, groaning, clawed hand reaching for the next step, and the inevitable weapon that would be lying around. Pitchfork, kitchen knife, axe. He was shouting things at varying intervals, but the words were still muffled as she scoured the kitchen counter and the sofa cushions for the phone. Finally, she located it in the drawer she'd tidied it into, underneath a tea towel. Staring at the handset, however, she realized that in her panic she couldn't remember the number for the police in England. She tried the Danish one, punching the numbers in, her breath coming fast. "This call cannot be connected." "Lord!" He mustn't know. "They're coming right now!" she yelled over her shoulder, almost cringing as she imagined his face peering around the bottom of the door, limbs free of their shackles, crawling across the space to kill her. She kept her eyes on the door as she punched in one of the numbers on the corkboard. There was the sound of glass and chatter at the other end, and then a familiar voice.
"Hello, the Fox and Hounds. How can I help?"
"Gavin!" she hissed. "It's me, it's Clara. Can you hear me?"
She pressed the phone into her ear, desperate to be in that pub, surrounded by people not about to stab her.
Who's me? Louisa, is that you? Are you calling from Spain? We're having a lock-in. It's like old times, but we miss you.
Clara didn't have time to ponder the fact that his voice sounded different, softer.
No, it's me, she repeated. Clara! Someone's broken in. I'm calling from the flat. He's downstairs right now.
Gavin had obviously heard enough to realize it was serious.
Clara? Okay, stay there, he said in a louder voice.
She felt instant relief that he was going to help her.
I'll be over in 2 seconds.
She heard him yell across the room.
Clive, I've got to go out for a few minutes. Man the bar and don't let anyone take the tip jar. It wasn't funny last time and it won't be funny now.
This added piece of normality made Clara feel reassured. She gripped the phone even tighter, knuckles strained white. Gavin's voice came back on the line.
You get yourself somewhere safe. I'm going to hang up now, okay, but I'm coming straight to you. Got that, Clara? It's okay, just get somewhere safe.
Thank you, Clara whispered, feeling her throat thicken with emotion.
She hung up and stood straining her ears for noise. Aside from her own breathing and the clashing chords of ominous imaginary music pounding in her head, she couldn't hear anything else. It had gone quiet downstairs, and she inched her way over to the door and glanced out. She sagged in relief. He was still tied up, still where she'd left him, though he was bucking back and forth trying to free himself from the wire. She had a momentary flicker of pride in her tying up burglar skills. Maybe she should barricade herself into the bathroom. Gavin wouldn't be long. He had sounded really worried. He'd be here soon. She should definitely hide. The man stopped bucking, perhaps seeing her silhouetted in the doorway.
I'm her son, he shouted from the fetal position. I'm Louisa's son, he repeated.
Clara froze. How did he know Louisa's name? A lucky guess? Had he seen Post in the corridor?
That's what a burglar would say, she called out uncertainly, taking a step back towards the flat door.
Lady Carcar suddenly woke up, shaking out her wings, craning her neck.
Joe! Joe! Master Joe! Love Island Joe!
Her squawking drowned out the start of what the burglar was now yelling at Clara.
The son of the woman who has let you house-sit, who has allowed you to reopen the toy shop she was planning to close, who has left you to care for a fucking nightmare of a parrot and the world's most laid-back cat. A burglar would know all that, would they?
He panted. Clara had started to feel dread Bill during his speech, and by the end she had rushed out of the flat, clattered down the stairs and was bent over him.
You're Louisa's son. You're Joe.
He looked up at her through a face full of wire, one eyelid clamped shut by a fairy light bulb.
I am. And you must be our house sitter.
Clara swallowed.
Clara,
she said in a small voice. Tentatively she started to attempt to unravel him.
So sorry. Here, let me... Sorry, there's a bulb under your, in your, thigh bit?
He was muttering, sweat along his hairline, red-cheeked, hair askew. Clara felt the heat flood her own face as she tried to detangle the bulbs, pulling her hand away as she accidentally brushed the crotch of his suit.
Sorry, there's a couple of tricky wires, she said, watching him slowly shake them off.
When he stood up, he seemed to fill the entire corridor, blocking out the bare bulb above him, smoothing his hair as he looked down his nose at her.
"Stay right there! Get away, Clara!"
came a shout from the doorway, and Gavin barreled into the corridor, flicking the switch so they were flooded with light. Clara blinked at the sudden change. Gavin marched down the corridor in Wellington boots, a tea towel still slung over one shoulder. The burglar, Louisa's son Joe, was standing in a pool of plastic wire, a red mark on the side of his face where she'd hit him with the pole, the hobby horse lying ominously on the floor. His brown hair was sticking up, and his grey eyes were glaring at her. She thought back to the photo she'd seen in the flat. Aside from the fact that the man in that had been smiling, it was definitely the same person. He was thinner in the face than she had imagined, paler, and a lot better dressed. That woolen overcoat looked designer, as did the suit underneath.
"Get away from her!"
Gavin called, stepping forward before Clara could warn him and twisting Joe's arm behind his back.
"Ah!"
Joe doubled over.
"Fuck!" "I've got him, Clara, don't panic."
Gavin twisted Joe's arm harder.
"Gah!" "Don't squirm," Gavin shouted. "It's all right, Clara, you're safe now."
Clara was holding both hands up, waving them, cutting him off.
"Gavin, it's okay. It's Joe. I was wrong, it's okay."
She watched Gavin's face register the words.
"Joe?"
he repeated, letting go of his arm and spinning him around to look him in the face.
"Joe, as in Louise's Joe?"
Gavin seemed flustered, leaping away from him.
"What the hell are you doing, creeping in here at 2 in the morning?
"I drove up from London. I was handling a deal in New York,"
Joe was saying, his mouth turned down. He bent to pull the wire from his feet.
"God forbid I get attacked entering my own home," he growled,
looking at Clara with such disgust she couldn't help flinching.
"Thought he was a burglar," she mumbled, almost to convince herself she had done the right thing.
The horse on the floor stared back at her with its glass eye.
"Well, why don't we get upstairs and warm up, eh?"
Gavin said, sensing that the atmosphere was about to turn even frostier.
"Good idea,"
Clara felt a rush of gratitude.
"I'll put the kettle on. The English like tea, yes? Tea fixes everything."
She padded back up the stairs in her slipper socks, aware of Louisa's lurid dressing gown, her pyjamas underneath. She moved to the counter, smoothing her hair. She never felt in control when not wearing a bra. She hadn't failed to notice that Joe, even puce with anger, was a bit gorgeous. Clicking on the kettle, she held her breath as Gavin and Joe moved into the flat. Joe was removing his overcoat, a smart navy suit and crisp white tie below. He looked absurdly overdressed in the eclectic space. Lady Carcar seemed the only one delighted to see him, marching up and down her pole, head flung back, repeating,
"Nice to see you! To see you nice, Joe!"
and not calling him a shithead once. Roddy merely opened one eye, noted that there were more people in the flat than normal, and rolled over again, his paws up around his face as if telling them all to shut the hell up and let him sleep.
"You've really done wonders," Gavin said, moving into the room, taking in the wiped-down surfaces, the clothes tidied away, the touches she'd added.
Clara nodded, grateful that he'd noticed the difference. The aching arms and red raw hands were a fine payoff if she had improved the place.
"You can see the floor for a start," Gavin laughed. "I never knew it was this big. Louisa just always seemed to have so much stuff. It looks so different."
He moved through the room, taking in the changes. Clara had discovered a stack of boxes and had put away 101 things, draping throws and blankets over sofas and chairs and adding lamps to every nook and cranny. Joe looked up from his iPhone, eyes scanning the room before dropping back down to the message he was tapping out. Clara felt her shoulders droop as the kettle clicked off, steam rising in a cloud. "Tea?" she asked.
"I'm not staying," Joe said, not looking up.
"Oh." Clara found herself shifting from one foot to the other. Something about Joe made her nervous. She was trying really hard not to keep apologizing. The livid red mark on his face didn't help relax her.
"You've got so many candles," Gavin said,
bending down to look at a cluster on either side of the wood burner. There were more all along the mantelpiece, on the nests of tables, lined up on the windowsills, all different heights and sizes.
"Bet they look brilliant when they're all lit."
"Probably burn the place down," muttered Joe, just loud enough for Clara to hear.
She felt herself stiffen.
"This rug might be the softest thing I've ever felt,"
Gavin said, moving across to reach a hand out, stroking the blanket that was folded up on the back of the rocking chair.
"It's so cozy in here," he added.
"I have some more things planned," Clara smiled over at him, glad of the distraction.
"'Going to get an architect in and bash down some walls, are you?'
Joe snapped, slipping his mobile into his inside pocket.
"'I—'
Clara's mouth hung open. She was too surprised to think of anything to say. She folded her arms in front of her defensively. Joe was rubbing at the red mark on his face.
"'Would you like some ice for that?' she asked, turning to the freezer.
"'What for the massive bump you made?' he said, eyes narrowed.
She bit her lip.
"'I really am sorry,' she paused. "'At least I was protecting your property,' she added, giving him a small smile. "'An attempt to charm.'
He looked back at her in stony silence. "'Too soon.'
"'Maybe I should get you to come into the pub, take a look around, give me some ideas,'
Gavin mused. He was in his own world now, oblivious to the frosty exchange in front of him.
"'I'd love that, Gavin,' Clara said, desperately rootling in the freezer for the ice cube tray.
Locating it, she stood up, pressing some pieces out onto a tea towel and offering it to Joe. He shook his head.
"'So where will you go?'
she blurted, watching him move around the flat, his lip curling as he took in the unmade bed, an abandoned bra on the floor. She felt heat creep into her face as he turned back to her.
"'I'll stay at the pub. You got a room, Gavin?' "'I've got a room. No need to pay,'
Gavin said, waving a hand in the air dismissively.
"'I'll pay,' Joe growled.
"'But really, that's silly. You can't stay there. Please, stay here. It's your home, your mum's.'
"'I'd rather not,'
he said, pulling out the phone from his pocket for what seemed like the 7 billionth time. Clara felt as if he had dropped the bag of ice on her.
"'No need to be a sphene.'
"'A what?'
"'Nothing,'
she mumbled, trying to remember that she had smashed this guy in the face and was sleeping in his home. She shouldn't be rude. But he was making her angrier and angrier with his narrowed eyes and his slick suits and his stupid tappity-tapping on the phone that never seemed to stop vibrating. She could feel cold water drip onto her leg and quickly deposited the ice in the sink behind her. Joe had moved across to get his coat. Lady Carcar, clearly sensing that he might be leaving again, started squawking as he shrugged it on.
"'I am your father!'
Gavin frowned.
"'Well, as fun as it is standing around here, I think I'd better get back. Long day tomorrow and all that.'
He turned to Clara.
"'You've got the new unveiling, haven't you?' "'Unveiling?'
Joe lifted an eyebrow in question.
"'Whole village is talking about it, Joe. She's had a countdown going in the window.' he explained.
Clara smiled weakly. The shop plans seemed a million years ago.
"'Something exciting?'
Gavin asked with a broad smile. Clara went to answer, but he held up a hand.
"'Don't ruin it for me. I'm curious too, you know.' "'Right, Joe, shall we get off? Leave Clara to get some sleep?'
"'I can stay at the pub instead. Let Joe—'
Clara began, guilt making her trip over her words.
Joe had already walked across to the door. "'No, please. I insist.'
His voice dripped with sarcasm.
"'But—'
Clara bit her lip as Gavin walked past, resting a hand on her arm.
"'I've got it,' he said under his breath.
She swallowed her feelings, nodding at him as she turned away. Joe had already left the flat, his footsteps loud on the stairs below. Chapter 13 Joe trudged along in silence next to Gavin, who, he noticed, had a tea towel slung over one shoulder. He drew up the collar of his winter overcoat, his temples still smarting from the blow from the pole. What had the bloody woman been thinking? Any harder and she might have killed him. He felt his head throb, the mild headache he always seemed to have now overwhelming him, so he barely paid attention to what Gavin was saying.
"'All changed a bit since you were last here, I imagine.'
Gavin indicated the shops opposite. Joe hadn't been looking, only now seeing the empty glass fronts, the final clearance signs in a couple of the windows. He grunted, not trusting himself to speak through the headache.
"'Louisa packing up seems to have made it all real,' Gavin went on. "'I always thought we were just going through a bit of a bad patch. like Gigglesworth a few miles away when the old pub on the corner closed and all the business went elsewhere. I thought we'd get through it, sit out the winter and start up again. Yulethorpe was voted best-kept village only 4 years ago.
It's a great place, he trailed off, his head bowed.
Bit of a backwater, Joe said. Not to those of us who live here.
Gavin's voice sounded gruff.
Joe shrugged. No need for a raft of shops when people can get everything online. 78% of the population buy things that way. The supermarkets deliver to the back of beyond.
How depressing, Gavin said. Joe paused. He'd never thought of it like that. He liked the convenience. He bristled at the implicit suggestion that he was doing things wrong.
I'm not too depressed when I'm eating wasabi prawn rolls delivered within the hour from the finest restaurant in London, and the internet means you can get things cheaper. Not that that's my concern, he couldn't help adding.
Did he imagine it, or did Gavin roll his eyes?
I suppose you like interacting every time you buy a sandwich, Joe said, a defensive edge to his voice.
He could hardly think through the throbbing in his head.
Gavin shrugged. I'm old-fashioned, I guess.
They'd reached the pub. Gavin led him in through the glass-panelled door. The room flooded with light that made them both blink. There was a bald man behind the bar stacking glasses on the edge of the counter.
All okay, Gavin. Everyone left. The tip jar hasn't been touched.
Gavin was thanking him as Joe looked around.
It really did look bleak.
Joe had never been inside the place before, though he'd heard all about it from his mother. The steak night, the Monday pub quiz, her games of darts with this Gavin character. Joe looked at him. He was enormous, round, meaty head resting on massive shoulders, a tattoo mostly hidden by his sleeve. Joe imagined a mermaid or a heart with an arrow. He knew he was being an asshole, but he couldn't seem to snap out of it. He just wanted to crawl into bed and sleep. He pressed lightly at the throbbing mark on his cheek.
I'll show you the room.
Gavin indicated the door to the left of the bar.
So what's she like? Joe blurted out.
Gavin gave him a blank stare. The clock on the wall reminded them both that it was now nearly 3 a.m.
Clara?
Joe nodded, resisting the urge to add, of course, Clara, who do you think I meant, Mother Teresa? His head was pounding now. It had been a long night after a long day. Gavin had a think.
She's one of those people who gets pleasure from the simpler things, you know?
Simpler things, repeated Joe.
You know, she stops to really drink things in, live in the moment. She's just... well, she's... peaceful.
Joe looked up at him in amazement, wanting to point at the livid bruise on his face. Peaceful she was not. Gavin rested a hand on the door handle.
She's done amazing things already with the shop. People were flocking in the day she made that first display. Display?
Joe raised an eyebrow.
She'd found all these old wooden toys, vintage pieces. I doubt Louisa even knew she had them in stock. You know what she's like, hoarding things, picking things up from all over the place. It was her passion.
Joe hadn't known that. It was years since he'd spent a decent amount of time at home. Louisa had started the shop when they'd moved to Yulethorpe over 20 years ago. Joe had been 12 years old and had thought a toy shop was the coolest thing. He'd always wanted to be in the shop with her, serving customers, showing off the toys, helping her to order new ones. They'd visited suppliers together. He'd felt like the luckiest boy ever. Then he became a teenager, discovered girls, joined the football team, wanted to get straight A's. When he moved to London to go to university and got his first job in the city, the shop had become just a quaint reminder of his childhood. He realized that in the last few years he'd stopped even really asking about it.
Well, she must have spent hours on it. The wooden tracks looping all over the window, the carriages looking spick and span, the backdrop all these different jigsaws made up to look like one big landscape. It was really very striking. She's creative, definitely. Louisa would have loved it,
Gavin looked off into the distance, a small sad smile on his face.
"What's in it for her?" Joe asked.